Monitor Monday is recorded before a live online audience. It's morning in America. It's Monitor Monday. For rural hospitals and small-town clinics, big city health systems, and healthcare professionals, Monday means Monitor Monday. And Monday means gearing up for another week of audits by the government and health plans. Here now with the latest regulatory and audit news is the publisher of RAC Monitor and the host of Monitor Monday, Chuck Buck.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to another live edition of Monitor Monday. On today's broadcast, the drug discount program 340B is in the CMS crosshairs again. We'll have an update on this developing story when the boss of 340B Health, Maureen Testoni, joins us later in the broadcast. Also on today's rundown, the Justice Department reports that 35 defendants have been charged for allegedly billing Medicare $2.1 billion for a scheme involving cancer testing laboratories and telemedicine companies. Mary Inman is standing by in London with a live report. Nicole Emanuel has an update on the Virginia Medicaid lawsuit. Alan Fink-Sandman continues with their exclusive reporting on the social determinants of health. Alan also has a Monitor Monday listener survey. And healthcare attorney David Glazer has another example of risky business. But we begin this morning with Dr. Ronald Hirsch, who is making his Monday rounds here on Monitor Monday.
Monday Rounds is sponsored by R1 RCM. Here now making his Monday Rounds is Dr. Ronald Hirsch.
Well, good morning, all. Early Thursday morning, a media report came out that the president would be signing an executive order that was reportedly to be entitled Protecting Medicare from Socialist Destruction. Now, when the text of the actual order was released, the title was changed to Protecting and Improving Medicare for Our Nation's Seniors. Now, before I go any further, let me emphasize this executive order does not result in any immediate changes. It simply directs the Secretary of Health and Human Services to make policy changes to obtain the goals set out in the executive order. That said, the goals in this order are going to be quite disruptive. First, it's clear this order favors the Medicare Advantage plans. They will be given more latitude in what they may offer, including paying patients cash or giving them rebates. The order hints that they will try to eliminate state certificate of need laws and restrictive covenants. They want to see FDA approval to more quickly result in Medicare coverage for expensive new drugs and expensive new technologies. This suggests that we'll soon see payment parity for Medicare for physicians and non-physician practitioners, which appears to be another step towards allowing independent practice by non-physician practitioners. This is certainly going to upset many physicians who went to 4 years of medical school and 3 to 7 years of residency and now get paid the same as a nurse practitioner who has much less education. Now, don't get mad at me since I'm a doctor saying that. I'm simply reporting and not taking a side. We may also see changes to the Medicare fee schedule as the order directs a modification to Medicare payments to more closely reflect those paid by commercial insurance plans. Now, this one's really baffling. In general, commercial payments are higher than Medicare, so why would they want to raise payments? Well, one policy wonk suggests they want to raise payments to speed the demise of fee-for-service Medicare to allow the transition to Medicare Advantage for all seniors to happen as soon as possible. Is that true? Who knows? Quality of care is also addressed in two ways. First, HHS is ordered to produce more data on both quality and cost to allow beneficiaries to make informed choices. And it also appears they want to expand the release of claims data to providers themselves so they can see if their practice pattern is, as the order says, outside the recommended standard of care, whatever that means. The order also stresses they want patients to have more choice. And to them, that actually means the ability to choose an MA plan rather than Medicare fee-for-service. But signing up with an MA plan does the exact opposite. As we just saw in Connecticut, where Anthem notified a large number of physicians that they were being dropped from their provider network, and in an article published last month, which showed Medicare Advantage patients were more likely to be treated by a low-quality home care agency than traditional Medicare patients. So I'd like them to explain how much choice and quality those Medicare Advantage patients will actually have. That's all for now. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Dr. Hirsch. That was the Vice President of R1 RCM, Ronald Hirsch, MD. Dr. Hirsch is making his Monday rounds here on Monitor Monday. Here now with the Monitor Monday RAC report and an update on the Virginia Medicaid lawsuit is healthcare attorney Nicole Emanuel. Good morning, Nicole. What's the latest coming out of Richmond?
Good morning and happy RAC Monitor Monday. As most of you are aware, Virginia's Medicaid program through its managed care organizations, or MCOs, have terminated over 100 healthcare providers, behavioral healthcare providers to be specific. We filed an verified complaint, and we're filing the amended verified complaint either today or Tuesday. Remember, we filed the skeleton complaint on September 25th, 2019, because numerous of the providers were having their terminations of their Medicaid contracts effective September 25th. When you get an injunction, you're asking the judge to maintain the status quo or the normalcy of the situation. So it was imperative to file September 25th, regardless of whether the skeleton complaint was complete or not. The plaintiffs began as approximately 10, but word has gotten out. More and more providers have come out of the woodwork. In fact, this past week on Friday, we had to call it. We shut down the number of plaintiffs who could continue to join. Interestingly, in a subject which we are not having a blind eye to, is that 33 of the 34 providers are African American. One is Asian Indian. The remaining 3 to 5 providers that the MCOs are allowing to remain in business in Virginia are all white owned. Who would have thought in 2019? We capped the number at 34 providers for this complaint. It's important to understand, though, that we're also representing Medicaid recipients on a pro bono basis because they bring us the extremely strong argument of freedom of choice of provider and access to care. Federal law dictates that Medicaid recipients can choose any qualified provider. By terminating qualified providers, the MCOs are violating the Medicaid recipients' freedom to choice of provider. Another important fact is that this is not a class action. We did not file this lawsuit on behalf of all terminated behavioral health care providers in Virginia. It is a pay-to-play scenario. Why this is important is that the federal injunction will help the named plaintiffs, but not all similarly situated providers. Since this past week, I don't know, like 10, 15 providers have contacted us to join the lawsuit. Sadly, and for the sake of time and the best interest of the named providers, we had to cut off the ability to join. However, all is not for naught. If we are successful, the late joining providers can join together to bring a second lawsuit. Think about how easy it'll be to win a second if we win the first. It may actually be cheaper for them. The terminations have become effective at different times. For example, some are effective October 31st, some November 2nd, some September 25th. Theoretically, the provider should be able to provide mental health services up to and until the day that the contract is actually terminated. However, despite this logical and legal understanding, I've had multiple providers complain that MCOs are already informing Medicaid recipients that the providers are going out of business and they need to choose new providers. We have received feedback from a few Medicaid recipients who want to testify on behalf of recipients. There's a 9-month wait for them to see their new behavioral health care providers. A question I get is whether the defendants know that we filed this. Our skeleton complaint put them on notice. We'll see what happens. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Nicole, very much. That was healthcare attorney Nicole Emanuel. Nicole is a partner in the Potomac Law Group. And coming up at about 10 minutes after the hour in your time zone, you're going to hear from Alan Fink-Samnick, David Glazer, Mary Inman, and our special guest, the president and CEO for 340B Health, Maureen Testoni, who's standing by in Washington with our lead story. This is Monday. It's October the 7th, and you're listening to Monitor Monday. Stand by.
What will earning the CCSP credential do for you? By earning a HEMA's industry-regarded Certified Coding Specialist physician-based credential, you can improve earning potential, expand career advancement opportunities, position yourself as a leader and role model in the industry, connect with a strong network of HEMA-certified peers, and much more. And with the HEMA's comprehensive virtual exam prep bundle, Gain access to an on-demand webinar series, virtual interactive learning session, exam prep book, and the exam voucher for one low price. Learn more at ahima.org/certification and plan to attend the October 16th virtual interactive learning session.
And now with the Monitor Monday Risky Business segment, here is healthcare attorney David Glazer. And David, what could be risky this morning?
Good morning, Chuck. So a listener, Sharon, sent me a question. She asks, our Medicare administrative contractor had a policy detailing their coverage of records documented by a scribe. That policy has been revoked. I've located a policy by CGS. Would it be appropriate to rely on that policy, even though we're not located within CGS's jurisdiction? Should I treat a policy from another MAC the same as I would from mine? Now, these are great questions, which I would answer, no, you shouldn't rely on the CGS policy, and yes, you should give it the same weight as you would a policy from your MAC. Now, that may seem contradictory, or perhaps flip, but the truth is, you should give the policy from another MAC jurisdiction exactly the same weight you would give to a policy from your own MAC, and that is, not that much. Over the last few weeks, we've discussed the enforceability of MAC policies. Because it's neither a statute nor a regulation, a MAC policy isn't binding. It can, however, offer some insight about how a MAC might approach a review of your charts. However, it's no guarantee your charts they'll apply it in a review. Your audit might be done by a RAC, by a ZPIC, by a UPIC, or any of the other of alphabet soup of government contractors. That reviewer might choose to apply the contractor policy, but they also might choose to disregard it. More importantly, when you're sitting before an administrative law judge, 42 CFR 405.1062A, that's 405.1062A, makes it clear that the policy is not binding on an ALJ. The bottom line is that the policy from your contractor is basically the same as one from another. It's a data point as you attempt to understand how reviewers may see an issue, but it doesn't have the force or effect of a regulation or a statute. Now, this particular CGS policy on scribes is a good example of why you should not give undue weight to a contractor policy. The policy starts out by citing the Joint Commission. Now, Joint Commission policy is utterly irrelevant for most physician practices and even for many hospitals who might be using some other method for certification. The policy includes this gem, quote, it is inappropriate for the scribe to see the patient separately from the physician and to make entries in the record unless the employee is licensed, certified NPP billing Medicare, for services under the NPP name and number. Now, that simple declarative sentence sounds authoritative, but think about it for a moment. Can a patient record information about his or her own history in the record? If I complete an online form about my HPI, does that count as medical record documentation? Of course it does, but I'm not licensed or certified, nor do I have a Medicare billing number. This policy, like many MAC policies, includes a purported requirement that is wholly made up, unsupported by any statute or regulation, and doesn't withstand even a modicum of scrutiny with common sense. It also incorporates provisions from a credentialing body that has no authority over a material portion of the healthcare marketplace. So, Chuck, Sharon is just a small-town woman living in a lonely world. Now, Journey correctly notes that the first level of appeal, some will win and some will lose. Some were born to sing the blues. But don't stop believing. By the time you hit the ALJ, the law should carry the day, and the LCD will be discounted unless it's supported by a higher authority. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Ed, very much. That was healthcare attorney David Glazer. David is a shareholder in the law firm of Frederickson & Byron in downtown Minneapolis. Here now with the very latest news on the hottest topic in healthcare is Alan Fink-Sandvik. Alan also has a Monitor Monday listener survey. And good morning, Alan. What's the latest when it comes to the social determinants of health?
Chuck, it's always an interesting world in the state of the social determinants of health, and this week is no exception. You know, our industry can be so predictable. I'd be a rich woman if I bet on what attention would be devoted to the social determinants of health each week. I expected at least one announcement based on our Monitor Monday report and RAC Monitor article on the limit expansion of coverage by Medicare Advantage plans for the social determinants. There were two big ones, and there continue to be stories emerging each day by the benefit plans. It's been about 2 weeks since the Urban Institute and Robert Wood Johnson Foundation identified how the five major Medicare Advantage plans weren't doing enough to address social determinants. Boom, press release time. Cigna and Humana each affirmed their attention and commitment to expand coverage for the social needs impacting their members' health. Humana's coverage will vary by region, including support for caregiving, transportation and medical appointments and fitness centers, acupuncture, home-delivered meals, and coverage for over-the-counter personal items like pill boxes and vitamins. Cigna's coverage will also vary by market, with benefits encompassing air conditioners, fall prevention, acupuncture, and transportation to places of worship, plus grocery stores. Both plans plan to offer dental and vision options, plus increased case management for Medicare Advantage populations. Telehealth access will also grow to capture expanded reimbursement by CMS. Of course, one wonders how the recent survey by the National Poll on Healthy Aging will impact this mix. The study yielded over 70% of respondents had concerns providers couldn't do a physical exam via webcam or smartphone, and 68% noted remote care wouldn't cut it. Not exactly a high level of confidence. Also in the state of social determinants of health this week, what's in a name? Well, many colleagues have shared with me how their organizations have reframed the social determinants. Some really proud of this renaming. They call them social influences, social drivers, social needs, and probably a whole slew of other framings I've not yet heard. The intent is valued to view social issues as potentially impacting, but not determining health outcomes. A kinder, gentler framing, perhaps. Those who know me know and can attest to my desire in always evolving our practice and perspective. However, sometimes it's better to let sleeping dogs lie. The more varied ways any construct is referred to, the less the industry understands what that construct is. It's concerning enough that despite there being five clear domains for the social determinants, a great many providers, practitioners, plus, still struggle with knowing what they are or how to assess for them. To that end, this week's Monitor Monday listener survey, sponsored by the American College of Physician Advisors, asks, how do you refer to the social determinants in your organization? A, the social determinants. B, social influencers. C, social drivers. D, something else. One programming note as you work through the survey, I'll be traveling to present at next week's Decision Healthcare Coordination Summit in Orlando, so we'll unfortunately miss our Monitor Monday broadcast, but I do want to wish my case management colleagues an outstanding case management week from 10/13 to 19 and every day. Celebrate every opportunity you can. We'll return to the survey results in a bit. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Alan, very much. That was consultant author Alan Fink-Sandvik. And by the way, Alan's new book, Social Determinants of Health, Case Management's Next Frontier, is now available in the RAC University bookstore. And as Alan said, we're going to have the results of the Monitor Monday listener survey later in the broadcast. The largest healthcare fraud ever was reported last week by the Justice Department. 35 defendants have been charged for allegedly billing Medicare $2.1 billion in a scheme involving cancer testing laboratories and telemedicine companies. Calling in live from London at this hour with the details is famed whistleblower attorney Mary Inman.
Last week, in two enforcement actions colorfully named Operation Double Helix and Operation Brace Yourself, which are largely unprecedented in their breadth and scope, the federal government brought charges against 35 individuals, including 9 doctors, in 5 federal districts in Florida, Louisiana, Georgia, and Texas for a scheme involving fraudulent genetic cancer testing results that allegedly defrauded Medicare out of over $2 billion. The enforcement actions were led by the Healthcare Fraud Unit of DOJ Criminal Division's Fraud Section in conjunction with its Medicare Fraud Strike Force, as well as the U.S. Attorney's Offices for the Middle and Southern Districts of Florida, Southern District of Georgia, and Eastern and Middle Districts of Louisiana. The Medicare Fraud Strike Force is a partnership among the Criminal Division, U.S. Attorney's Offices, the FBI, DEA, and HHS-OIG. This is certainly a crew of agencies you would not want investigating you. The alleged fraud centers around genetic tests for cancer, commonly known as CGX tests. Broadly speaking, several CGX labs are accused of paying kickbacks to illegally capture referrals from fraudulent telemedicine companies. The government alleges that the vast majority of these tests were medically unnecessary. This is in violation of the anti-kickback statute, which prohibits medical providers from paying or receiving kickbacks, remuneration, or anything of value in exchange for referrals of patients who will receive treatment paid for by government health care programs such as Medicare and Medicaid, and from entering into certain kinds of financial relationships. Also in violation of several federal laws that restrict government-funded healthcare programs to only paying for services, supplies, or equipment that are reasonable and necessary for the diagnosis or treatment of illness or injury. Additionally, the government's allegations would violate the False Claims Act, which prohibits defrauding or overcharging the government for goods or services. The False Claims Act also has a whistleblower provision that, although not used in this case, allows private individuals to bring suits on behalf of the United States and potentially share in any recovery. Most of the genetic cancer testing at issue was prescribed without any interaction between a physician and a patient, or after only a brief phone call. This could be one of the biggest healthcare fraud cases of all time, and we will keep RAC Monitor listeners posted on any new developments. To quote United States Attorney Bobby L. Christine of the Southern District of Georgia, "Our office charged more defendants responsible for more healthcare fraud losses than ever before in this office's history. While these charges might be some of the first, they won't be the last. We'll keep you updated as things unfold." Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Mary. Calling in live from London was famed whistleblower attorney Mary Inman. Mary is a partner in the law office of Constantine Cannon. As we mentioned at the top of the broadcast, the drug discount program 340B is in CMS crosshairs again. With the very latest on this developing story, we switch live to Washington. We check in with the president and the CEO for 340B Health, Maureen Testoni. And good morning, Maureen. So, Maureen, what is CMS up to, and what do they expect out of this situation?
Thank you, Chuck. It's a real pleasure to join you again today. I appreciate the opportunity to update our audience on developments involving the 340B drug pricing program. As you know, 340B is a key part of our national healthcare safety net. Under this bipartisan law, pharmaceutical companies are required to sell many outpatient drugs at a discount to certain hospitals, clinics, and health centers that serve large numbers of low-income patients. These discounts then allow safety net providers to stretch their resources to serve more patients and offer more comprehensive services. Our organization, 340B Health, represents more than 1,400 hospitals that participate in 340B. These are all nonprofit or public hospitals, and they must meet some very high standards to participate in the program. For example, patients with low incomes who are on Medicaid and Medicare must make up at least 27% of total patient load. The fact is, the average low-income patient load for our hospitals is 42%. And 340B hospitals provide 2/3 of all inpatient care to people with Medicaid. 340B hospitals provide 60% of all uncompensated care in the country, even though they represent only 38% of acute care hospitals. They're also much more likely to offer services that are vital to patients' health, but often are under-reimbursed or not reimbursed at all. Things like trauma care, neonatal services, HIV/AIDS care, and prevention and treatment of opioid dependency. The 340B program has enjoyed strong bipartisan support since it was signed into law by President George H.W. Bush in 1992. Unfortunately, in 2017, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services issued regulations to deeply cut what Medicare pays 340B hospitals for services involving drugs. They reduced payments by nearly 30%, and that has led many hospitals to have to find ways to cut back on costs while trying hard to protect patient services. Those cuts have been challenged in the courts, and a federal judge has said CMS overstepped its authority and called the cuts unlawful. He ordered CMS to come up with a way to repay the hospitals the money they lost. The government is appealing that decision, and oral arguments are expected next month. They also recently announced they plan to continue the cuts in 2020. In the meantime, CMS has been looking for ways to justify these cuts. They have even floated the idea of replacing the 30% cut with a 9% cut. That is still a discriminatory policy, and we are strongly opposed. Just last week, CMS announced that it wants to collect data from 340B hospitals on how much they pay for certain drugs. We believe CMS wants to collect this information to try to rationalize paying safety net hospitals less than hospitals that don't participate in 340B. Even less than they pay 340B hospitals now. That's the wrong policy, and we'll continue to fight them in every way we can to protect our hospitals and, more importantly, the patients that rely on them for their care. We expect a decision on the appeal in the next few months. In the meantime, 340B hospitals must continue to suffer these cuts despite the high percentage of low-income patients they treat. The bottom line is CMS must stop the cuts to 340B hospitals and repay all of those lost dollars plus interest so that our safety net remains strong for hospitals, patients, and communities. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Maureen, very much for that update. That was the President and CEO for 340B Health, Maureen Testoni. And now is the time for the results of today's Monitor Money listener survey. And once again, here is Alan Fink-Samnick.
The results of the survey are interesting because they're a little different from what I'm hearing from the case managers who have the boots on the grounds and facilities. How do you refer to the social determinants in your organization? 69, so almost 70% of users said that exactly how we know them, the social determinants. 7% said social influencers, another 7% said social drivers. And what was interesting, if not fascinating, with 16.5% said something else, one can only imagine where this one would go. Back to you, Chuck.
David, let's take a look at the questions coming in. There was a question for our good friend Nicole.
There is indeed. So, Nicole, did you cherry pick the 34 organizations that were included in the lawsuit, and why did you cap it at that number?
No, we did not cherry pick the providers. It was first come, first served. And the reason we had to cap it is because the more providers wanted to join the lawsuit, it was delaying us filing the injunction and getting relief. So the providers that came at the beginning were waiting for a long time to get relief. So we just decided, hey, we've got to pull the plug and go ahead and get in front of a judge.
Thanks, Nicole. And Ellen, quick question for you. Who is tracking the social determinants of health in either the clinic or hospital settings?
A number of folks are. The American Hospital Association, back March a year ago, said it is really the responsibility of the interprofessional team to document any opportunity to comment on a patient, client, member, consumer with dealing with a social determinant. And as far as coding it, well, the CDI specialists have really stepped up. They are the primary players involved. Periodically, you will see some of the revenue management specialists involved, but it has very much become a coding coalition party, if you will.
Thanks, Ellen. And Chuck, I'll turn it back to you.
Thanks, Ed, very much. That's going to be a wrap for this live edition of Monitor Monday. And we thank you so very much for being with us today. And special thanks to our outstanding panel panelists, Nicole Emanuel, Alan Fink, Sam McDavid Glazer, Mary Inman, Dr. Ronald Hirsch, and our special guest, Maureen Testoni, the president and CEO for 340B Health. And remember, you can listen to all the Monitor Monday podcasts anytime, anywhere, on any device, and it's free. You can listen to us on Stitcher, Apple, Spotify, and Google Play. And when you do, rate us. Give us a review. Until next Monday, I'm Chuck Buck, reporting for Monitor Monday and Rack Monitor. Have a great week, everyone.
Monitor Monday is a presentation of Rack Monitor.